Hello and welcome to MPN Forum Live, the home to MPN patient storytelling, the only podcast specifically designed for patients and caregivers of MPNs, which include the following blood cancers: PV, ET, and myelofibrosis. From the dawn of time, human beings have shared a deep history of bonding with each other through storytelling. These stories provide MPN patients and their families with a unique experience not easily replicated on traditional social platforms. Besides patient stories, from time to time we will feature guest hosts, caregivers, hematologists, and experts who can provide insight into medical breakthroughs and the benefits of exercise and a well-balanced diet. We are funded through donations from our listeners and grants from CTI Biopharma and Insight. MPN Forum is completely independent from outside influence and is reliant on donations from our listeners. Anyone interested in making a much-appreciated donation can go out to our website, mpnforumlive.com. Please click on the donation tab and you can donate via check or PayPal. All views and comments presented on MPN Forum Live are the opinions of our guests and hosts and are not to be taken as professional medical advice. Always check with your hematologist or oncologist should you be interested in learning more about a topic discussed on MPN Forum Live. As most of you know, I have been a passionate advocate for all MPN patients when it comes to diet and exercise, and believe it's the key to surviving longer and living a higher quality life, regardless of what MPN you may have. Today's guest on MPN Forum Live is Christina Gowan, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Arizona. I heard her speak this year at the Hutch Center Seattle Patient Conference, and she delivered an incredibly passionate presentation entitled Living Well Amidst Your Disease, and spoke about how important exercise and diet are to improving your quality of life, reducing inflammation, and so much more. Hello, Christina, and welcome to MPN Forum Live.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. I'm so honored to be here, and I'm really honored that you feel this topic is important to discuss, because it's not all about numbers, right? It's about our quality of life. And then not only is it about quality of life, it's about how can you as a patient really start to be proactive and feel empowered to start doing something about your own health. And I think that's really the power of what integrative medicine is. And so that's what we're talking about today, really, is integrative medicine. And I'm really passionate about this topic. I like to think that this is a new specialty arising in not only cancer care, but really all of our specialties in primary care, is how do we start integrating all of these wonderful modalities into our mainstream medicine. So I'd like to talk about integrative oncology today, and maybe we can start with a definition of what is integrative oncology. So this was from the Society of Integrative Oncology, and they did this in 2017, and really developed this evidence-based kind of description of this emerging specialty. And so I'll read this to you. Integrative oncology is a patient-centered, evidence-informed field of cancer care that utilizes mind and body practices, natural products, and lifestyle modifications from different traditions alongside, and this is really what differentiates integrative medicine from complementary and alternative medicine, is that it's truly alongside. We're still utilizing all of our Western allopathic techniques, precision cancer care, but we're using it, again, alongside the complementary and alternative modalities. Integrative oncology aims to optimize health, quality of life, and clinical outcomes across the cancer care continuum, and to empower people. And I love this. I think this is, again, the strength of this kind of medicine, is that it truly does empower you to prevent cancer and become active participants before, during, and beyond cancer treatment. And so I really think, again, this empowering aspect of lifestyle modification and integrative medicine, it can't be overstated. And I run into this every week in clinic when I have the luxury of doing integrative oncology visits, that patients will reflect that back to me and say, I am so grateful finally to have something I can do beyond just show up to my visits, beyond just to take my, my JAK inhibitor every day. There's something I can do. So I wonder, Jeremy, your experience, do you feel like that's true, that it's kind of empowered you in your path?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I looked at this from a business perspective and came up with a business, I took my business plan for my company and I wrote an MPN plan for myself and decided that there were two ways to approach this. One was I can just follow what the doctors tell me and do that and be kind of like in passive patient and just listen to whatever they tell me. Or I can go beyond that and start building my own sort of tools that help me feel better that go along with it. And then I realized, because I love the word, the integrated part of things, I started writing everything down. I started paying for my own CBCs so I could track my cholesterol, inflammation, C-reactive protein, all of those things. I started measuring them. And, I realized that doctors will at least look at data, even if they don't necessarily believe that the data comes to the same conclusion that I may believe. But back then in 1989, when I was first diagnosed, there's all these other outside things if you go hunting for them, that it turns out, like when I had PV, my biggest worry was platelets and rising counts. And so the one of the things that I read, there was a cancer study that showed that platelets were their thickest at night around midnight. So I started taking my medicine. I stayed up later and started taking, at the time I was taking hydroxyurea, I started taking my medicine at 11 p.m. thinking that it can't hurt. I started doing things like that. I started going on getting a little bit back into competitive cycling. I lost 60 pounds through diet. I went to the Mayo Clinic and met their head of cardiology. And that's when I was first introduced. That was back in 2008. So that was part of the journey along the way. And they put me on the Mediterranean diet. And so I've kind of followed that along the way. And then every once in a while, I still treat myself to a Big Mac or a quarter pounder with cheese, which I know isn't the healthiest thing in the world, but it provides me with some sort of fun junk that I can eat once in a while. But, it all started coming together. And I started noticing that there were, in the cancer side of things, there was more integration of nutritionists, more integrations of people. Like the Mayo had a team of people that you could go see that measure your ability to stretch, and they go through this whole process with you that allows you to, even if you have like an Apple Watch or a Fitbit or something like that, you can send them the cardio data and they'll measure it. And I think that, along with nutrition and dietary changes, because the cool thing about diet is that you can, it's much more, whatever prescriptions are out there, we know that with patients, some patients respond better to drug A, drug B, drug C, but food's a bit different. And so, you know, food is almost a whole other process. So I started seeing at the Mayo Clinic how they were beginning to, as you talk about, integrate some of these things together. And so I spent a lot of time with Dr. Mesa there when he was there, and learned a lot from him, and then started integrating that back at home in California with my doctor at Stanford.
It sounds like you really had a fantastic team and experience with integrative oncology, which is unfortunately, I think, really not the norm yet. And so I think that's something that I really hope for as a field that we can really aspire to, is this multidisciplinary model where every MPN patient not only gets this fantastic education about what is MPN and what is your therapy and how to monitor your disease, but how do you, in a really intentional way, focus on your lifestyle and personalize your treatment plan. And Jeremy, it sounds like you were really proactive and you kind of really took it upon yourself, which was fantastic. But I hope we can again aspire to that being part of our treatment plan for our patients. And you're doing a lot of the things that I would recommend, absolutely. Talking about the Mediterranean diet, I think, you know, as far as a blanket recommendation, the one intervention, besides stress reduction, which I also think is important, we'll talk more about that, I think. But I think the Mediterranean diet has the capacity to truly change the biochemistry. And we see that from really high quality data that's out there in the literature that is really in the cardiovascular disease space, where we have the PREDIMED study, which is over 7,000 cardiovascular disease patients that were randomized to a Mediterranean diet. And they saw with those that are eating the most of those kind of Mediterranean-like foods and extra virgin olive oil, more than nuts. So lots of EVOO, lots of Mediterranean foods. And so maybe we should describe what those are. It's really, you know, plant forward, sure, lots of vegetables, lots of fruits, lots of berries, healthy fats, fatty fish, low red meat, low processed sugar, and some red wine. And that's really the Mediterranean diet. And so folks that were eating more of those foods really had a lower instance of cardiovascular events and cardiovascular death, which is important for MPN patients, particularly if you have ET and PV, but also I think really speaks to that kind of underlying mechanism of what is the Mediterranean diet doing? And it's really cooling inflammation. And we know, and we can see that in the bloodstream, we've measured that in many of these trials, looking at some of the circulating cytokines, interleukins, you probably heard of, tumor necrosis factor, alpha, CRP. So a lot of our MPN trials look at that, and really the biology of MPNs we know is very much tied to inflammation. And what is the risk of a Mediterranean diet? It's absolutely nil as far as a therapy. So my gosh, we should really, I think, as a field, be looking at educating all of our patients for a Mediterranean diet. Now, here's the naysayers. They would say this, but there's no randomized controlled trials in MPNs to show this impacts outcomes. And that's fair. That's fair. That's true. But again, we have this high quality evidence in cardiovascular disease. And then we weigh that with the potential risk of Mediterranean diet, which is nothing really. Right. That I think, you know, it really is very convincing to undertake that kind of intervention.
Well, I also believe that one of the things that you're doing and others are doing with this integrative approach is it's really hard for the average consumer to understand how they're being manipulated by the food industry, which is what I actually make my living in. And so like that you could read Men's Health, for example, or Women's Health magazine, and every month they have a different story on product A or product B, and they're designed to sell these quick diets and other products and tie them all together. And I think that it's really hard for consumers to understand what they should be on. Like the Mediterranean is a very balanced diet and it's easy to adapt to. It doesn't require a lot of restrictions from the standpoint of saying, yeah, you may not be able to eat as much red meat as you would have in the past, but it doesn't prohibit you from having a little bit. And then you can still eat chicken, you can eat fish, you can eat pasta. So it's not like some of these other diets, which are eliminate everything except for A, B, and C. And that's much harder, both psychologically and physically, for someone to switch to. And I was, to give you an example, I probably, when I stopped drinking Coca-Cola, I think Coke stock dropped probably $10 a share because I literally consumed so much Coca-Cola and McDonald's when I was traveling, it was very unhealthy for me. But you don't always understand those things and what the impact are, because the human body is an amazing piece of work and has the ability to do a lot of adjusting until you break it. And so, I think that with integrated medicine, I think patients are more, or consumers are more likely to embrace healthier eating, because you're in an environment that is very good at measuring results as well. And doctors are trusted more than food brands are. And I think that it's because food brands will take advantage marketing wise of anything. So if a study comes out and says this is what you should be eating, then General Mills will come out with their own version of unhealthy Mediterranean diet foods, because they're going to make them as cheaply as possible. And so I think through education and doctors being involved, there's this opportunity to fundamentally change how everyone in the United States eats, not just MPM patients. But I really believe that that's where the change, the fundamental change is going to come, not from the food companies and the exercise and diet companies, but more from the medical community.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And I really liked what you said about the Mediterranean diet being something that is pretty easy to adapt to. And it's patient friendly. And so I would agree with that, that that's been my experience. And I think what is key is when you're embarking upon this journey is to really have an advocate with you who understands nutrition, understands the Mediterranean diet, and can sit down with you and really look at your food preferences, your culture, and say, how do we really personalize this plan for you? How do we make this adaptable for you? And how do we identify some stepwise goals to get you there to the end game? Because, you know, I think, you know, coming from McDonald's and Coca-Cola, going to this really beautiful, balanced Mediterranean diet is like 0 to 100. And so, you know, it takes many steps to get there. And I think it's key to really identify a strategic roadmap, if you will, of how to get from point A to point B in a really mindful but doable way for you, and everyone's different. You know, some can go from 0 to 100, and others it really takes some mindful steps. So I think, you know, the first thing is to getting rid of fast food, sugar, sweetened beverages. I think that's probably always the first one. And then I always focus on not what you're eliminating. Like you mentioned, it's not about what you're eliminating, but really, what are you getting in a day? How many cups of fruit and vegetables are you really getting in? And is there more vegetables than fruit? And is there a lot of color on your plate? Are you getting your omega-3 fatty acids in? Because we know that omega-3 fatty acids are one of the most potent drivers of decreasing inflammation. So really it's omega-6s that are driving those prostaglandins, which is kind of this mediator of inflammation in our body. And omega-3s cool their synthesis, their production. So omega-3 fatty acids are so, so important. So that's an intervention that I always try to get patients to move forward is, you know, really try to get your fruits and veggies in, really getting 4 to 5 cups if possible, and really trying to get your omega-3s in. And the way to do that is a couple servings of well-caught salmon per week is really a nice way to do that. But also there's plant sources, right? So you can do certainly flaxseed, chia seeds, hemp heart, walnuts. And so those are easy kind of strategies to start moving forward. And I tell you, Jeremy, all day long on the Mediterranean diet, because there's so much interesting things that we can talk about as food as medicine. I mean, there's so many things within Asian mushrooms and green tea and cruciferous family and how they all have these different molecules that are interacting not only with our cells, but our genes and regulating our genes. And so it's just fantastic science, and it's really phenomenally interesting. But I think, you know, taking it from food to supplements is another step. And so I love food as medicine. And I love drinking, for example, green tea, 2 to 4 cups of green tea per day. But am I convinced that we need to be supplementing with the active ingredient of green tea, e.g. CG? No, I'm not convinced. So I think there's still a lot of, you know, food, the power of food and medicine, and that sometimes in Western cultures and medicine, we want to simplify it and encapsulate it and take it in a pill, when really the answer is food as medicine.
Well, I think the problem is that in this battle between supplements and food is that what a lot of people don't understand is your body's ability to absorb something. Your body is designed to absorb the nutrients in the food. It's not designed to absorb a supplement, although some supplements are effective if you have a true deficiency and are unable to absorb. I had read this study originally about, it was one of the best pieces Men's Health had done about acai berries. And they were making claims that you were getting double the amount of antioxidants than you would get from eating regular blueberries. But they weren't, I think they brought in Duke University to do a full analysis of it. And they went in and they showed that the body doesn't absorb the acai berry juices. And so it's really just going through the body and being turned into waste, as to where the blueberries remain in your body for a longer period of time. And the benefits of a blueberry versus a quick drink of acai were far superior in the body's ability to use that resource. So you were actually getting more antioxidants from the blueberries, the fresh blueberries, than you were from the acai berries. And it kind of upended the acai industry, because, you know, they come up with these marketing terms like superfoods, which there's really no such thing as a superfood. by definition, but there's marketing terms that then convince the consumer that, wow, if it's a superfood, I'm getting something better than I am from my apples and my normal vegetables. So how do you explain to patients the difference between, in a simple way, especially MPN patients, the benefits of trying to get their normal vitamins and antioxidants from fruits and vegetables versus supplements?
Well, I think your example of the blueberries and the acai is so beautiful. And I think, you know, I always go back to the concept that nature is so much smarter than we are. Nature and plants have so much intelligence that we as scientists have not yet figured out all the underlying mechanisms, right? And the idea, going back to your example of the blueberry, that the fiber that's encapsulating those antioxidants slows the absorption, right? What an elegant, natural way that nature has developed to really deliver the antioxidants. So we, again, as scientists want to, you know, isolate and deliver, but we're missing some critical elements that nature did not. And so I always highlight the idea that nature and plant synergy is much smarter than we are as of yet. We have not really gained enough knowledge to understand all of the pieces of each plant and how they work together to really enhance our health and well-being. And so when I give talks, I often show this picture of a clear capsule. And inside that clear capsule is stuffed all of these fruits and vegetables, because that's really the power of nutrition and plant medicine, is all that synergy and the antioxidants that are within the whole plant and the fiber of the whole plant. And so often my job is, and particularly in my integrative clinic, is really eliminating supplements more than adding. I very rarely add or recommend many supplements. I really go back to food as medicine, plant synergy, and that's really where the power of nutrition is. How do you think that's received, Jeremy? Do you think they want to hear more?
Well, yes, I you know, I would say that if you went into a lot of the forums on Facebook with MPN patients, diet and exercise, but especially diet, are some of the, and supplements are the most talked about subjects. You can only talk about an MPN and what medicine you're taking for so long, but then people always want to know, well, what are you doing? You've lived 33 years with this. What are you doing differently? And I said, you know, besides changing my diet, losing weight, exercising regularly, you know, not a lot. I mean, you know, it's not like I fundamentally changed who I am as a person. I just changed, you know, it's like putting better gasoline for fuel into my body so that my body, and I notice the difference. Like if we go out for dinner at a restaurant and I have a heavy dessert, let's say, I notice that my spleen reacts negatively to it, to the sugar, that sometimes I get pain. And then once it's processed through my system, I don't have it. The pain is gone. And if, as long as I don't go back to eating that. Now, that's not scientific, but with me, I notice every time when I have a heavy dessert, I get those issues. So I still have a sweet tooth. And so my dirty bars are my Kit Kat bars. I still love those and I freeze them, but I, instead of eating a bar, I get the really small ones and I take them in small quantities and treat myself But I've also switched to more plant-based ice creams if I want to have an ice cream, so it's not heavy in the wrong type of fats and high in sugar. And so, because, you know, nobody wants to, you know, people love food. And you don't want to live a life where you're completely consumed by what you eat or don't eat. And so you still want to enjoy when you go out with friends and family, or you're at home cooking and have good things. And fortunately, whether it's being on a Mediterranean diet or a combination of that and a plant-based diet, there are many benefits that from those broad diets that allow you to consume enjoyable meals just like you did prior to being diagnosed with your MPN. One question I have for you is, how do we get from your world that you live in every day? You know, I'm very fortunate. I have great health insurance. It's not inexpensive, unfortunately, but I can go anywhere. So I get to go to the Mayo Clinic. I get to go to the Hutch. I get to go to see Dr. Mesa, and I go to Stanford. There's a lot of people that don't have those centers, and those centers are the ones that are more likely to have the budgets to build or launch an integrated medicine. Although I will tell you, I think Stanford needs to embrace this more, because the departments are kind of separated and you don't always hear about it unless your doctor tells you about it. But so my question is, how do you get this out to this messaging out to the local hematologist in Biloxi, Mississippi, who's treating patients there and isn't part of Dr. Mesa and your world and some of these other things? How do we do that? And I know Dr. Mesa is really doing a lot to try and bring education to minority communities and really reaching out. And I think that's great. But how do we do that with this integrated medicine and get that out to the broader market so that MPN patients who can't go to or don't live near a Mayo Clinic are getting the same type of information that you would get for the most part? You can't get everything because these are big research centers, a lot of them. How do you from your world help drive this forward?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the wonderful things about the MPN community is that everyone is so engaged online and as a community and proactive as well. And so I think it's really kind of a grassroots approach, if you will, in that a lot of the patients have to advocate for themselves, and they and many of them will see me via telemedicine and are seeking out a second opinion consult just for that reason, right? And so I think, you know, a lot of it is unfortunately patient advocacy, really getting to the patients, to the patient's advocate centers, and really trying to educate how important this is. But then also for us, it's kind of been my own mission that as many conferences as possible, I try to attend and to try to educate my peers, attend dinner meetings, educate my peers on why this is important, to try to write and publish. There's a book out there, Living Well with an MPN, that the MPN Research Foundation was distributing. We need to do an updated version, actually. But I think that helped the whole momentum of this moving forward. And then for us as researchers, we have to move the ball forward in regards to the medical research. And so that's all in writing grants, collaborating, and really, again, pushing the evidence base forward. So we no longer have to convince, because it's very clear in the literature that this improves outcomes. So I think that's where we have to start. I want to actually return to something that you said, if I can.
Go ahead. We have a little bit of time.
Your Kit Kats.
Oh, my kick.
I love that. Yes. And so I will say that in clinic, I talk about four pillars of wellness, and we talk about care of the mind.
Well, I'm sure the Kit Kat bar is not in the wellness category.
No, it is. It is. So there's four pillars. So care of the mind, care of the body, care of connection, spirituality, however you want to name that. But the final pillar is joy. Joy is wellness. And so we have to have things in our life that are stimulating joy. And in diet, it certainly can't all be driven by diet and Kit Kats. But, you know, 90% of our diet, if chosen in a well-mindful way, and 10% having these little cheats for holidays, for little treats, I think is really appropriate. And I put that into the joy category. But I can't overstate how impressive the joy category has been for patients on their journey. And I think we overlook that in medicine, that it's our job as patients and as providers to really focus on joy and gratitude and wellness and how to bring that into our life. And it's not talked about enough, I believe.
Well, I think that doctors in general have a tendency to talk in general terms. So they'll talk about meditation and yoga and how important those things are. But then the next step is, well, what are you going to do to help that patient go down that path? And I think that, or at least encourage them to explore that. And I think that sometimes is a step that gets missed. And, because the patient, you know, there's a lot of MPM patients suffer from depression. And when you get depressed, you generally don't seek out joy, as you were saying, because you're depressed, you know? And so I think almost every patient goes through the same sort of cycle. In the beginning, there's the shock of the diagnosis. You've never heard of this thing. I wasn't paying attention when the doctor told me I needed to get a phlebotomy, and I actually didn't know what a phlebotomy was. I first thought they said lobotomy. And so,
oh my.
So the nurse started laughing when I was talking to the doctor about it. And then, but it's all, then you get to the point where you get acceptance, and then you begin to say, okay, what now? How do I move forward in a positive direction? And so that's why I think a lot of the support groups online are important to get people grounded faster, because, you know, there's the point where you sort of feel helpless. And, you know, and another thing I think doctors need to do a better job at is bringing psychologists and psychiatrists in early to help the patient. Because first of all, when it first happens, when you first get the diagnosis, if you try and talk to your family member, one of the weird things that I learned about this on my journey is that it is true, and I hate to admit it, that it's really hard for non-cancer patients to understand what a cancer patient is going through. And so you go through this period where everyone's always asking you, are you okay? Are you okay? All I want to be treated like is normal. I just, let's go talk about the baseball game. I don't want to talk about my health. Let's talk. And so, but you go through these whole things in your mind. And I fortunately was a little more forward thinking and started seeing a therapist within my first year of being diagnosed, because after a while I realized, who wants to hear me babble on about how I'm feeling at the moment and I'm depressed and, you know, my life is over, you know. And, you know, when I was going through, when I was first diagnosed, I was going through a divorce. I wound up getting custody of my three kids. So I had a lot of stuff going on, and the place to go really wasn't my friends, because I needed somebody, a doctor, a psychiatrist or psychologist that could provide me with the tools and the mechanism to begin to rebuild my life and to get a foundation for stability, so that you then can begin to go on and start thinking about, okay, all right, today's a joyful day. I'm going to start eating right. I'm going to start doing this. But if you're not in that mental phase yet, you're more about just trying to survive. And just trying to survive sometimes leads you down all different paths of not eating healthy, not exercising, just sitting on the couch and getting depressed. And so, you know, I'm still proud that I've never missed a day of work because of my MPN. And, but at the same time, I know not every patient, has those options, because I'm very fortunate that I don't have the fatigue that most patients have. Why? No one knows, but, that can be very debilitating. And so if you're overweight, like I used to be overweight, fatigued in the beginning, I did have a problem with fatigue. But when you begin to change your diet and you begin to look at things different mentally, at least for me, I have very little fatigue and can stay consistent. So I know we're running up against a clock because you've got to go. I was wondering, I have some questions from some folks at MPN Life, which is our Facebook page. And I called it MPN Life because it's about life. It's not about dying, and it's not about the MPN necessarily. It's about saying, okay, I've got this disease. Now, how do I live a normal life? And so I love that. Thank you. I've got some questions that I'd like to roll through with you quickly. And then we'll wrap up so that you can get to your next appointment. So this is from Fernando Alonso. It's already known that many MPN patients take large amounts of supplements, vitamin D, blah, 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 blah. Some, motivated by information shared by other patients in Facebook groups. Do taking supplements really help us MPN patients, or is it a good and balanced Mediterranean diet enough?
Really a great question. This gets back to exactly what we were talking about early on. And I think going back to the basics, that really the foundation of a well-balanced, colorful Mediterranean diet with rich omega-3 fatty acids and limited processed sugar, really for me is enough. But I think there are a few exceptions. One is that in many different disease states, although it's less well characterized in MPNs, but particularly breast cancer, prostate cancer, we know vitamin D is very, very important, and deficiency. And we know deficiency in MPN patients is very prevalent. So that is one that I often do recommend supplementation. I usually measure vitamin D in the serum and target in the range of 50. We call deficiency less than 20. So I tend to target somewhere around 50. Now, you can get too much of a good thing. And so if it's ever reaching above 80 or so, that's too much. And so I think this is where we do some targeted kind of precision medicine here. Curcumin is another one that's kind of controversial, but it certainly is provocative. We know that there's a lot of the pathways that drive cancer are cooled with curcumin, and it is actually a natural JAK-STAT inhibitor. But here's the caveat, is that it's metabolized through a process within the liver called the CYP pathway, the same one that 60% of our pharmaceuticals are processed through. So we have to be really careful about drug interactions. You can get curcumin or turmeric from food, but it's hard to get the right concentrations. And getting back to your comment on absorption, right? Curcumin or turmeric is a really good example of that. It's hard to really absorb the curcumin from that turmeric at high concentrations without supplementation. So to kind of circle back around to that, that question, in general, I really focus on food as medicine with a couple of exceptions.
Great. Lori Lawler asks, are there any supplements or anything we can eat to reduce the inflammation myelofibrosis causes? Is there anything we can do to cleanse our spleen?
As far as supplements and inflammation, I think the most impactful supplement to reduce inflammation is really an omega-3 fatty acid. And we did actually a survey of over 270 MPN patients and asked them what supplements they were using and actually correlated that to the MPN symptom burden. And the only one that actually had a signal was omega-3 fatty acid. And so, you know, that's observational. That's not a randomized controlled trial, but that I think we also know the mechanism of how omega-3 fatty acids cool inflammation. And there's lots of data out there of how it can improve pain control via reducing inflammation, particularly in rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis. So that's one that definitely cools inflammation. And I often recommend, particularly if they're not fish eaters and getting enough in their diet. And again, curcumin is another one that certainly can cool inflammation, but we have to be careful with that. As far as spleen cleaning, that's a kind of an interesting question. There's nothing that I can think of that there's a supplement that helps to really truly cleanse out the spleen. Now in the liver, there's some thoughts of milk thistle, dandelion greens, and you know, that looks to be relatively safe, although I don't think the data on improvement of the metabolism within the liver is enough for me to ever truly recommend it. In some patients that are really feeling strongly like they want to do a cleanse, I recommend that they actually not juice, but use like a Vitamix and eat dandelion greens. Okay. And dandelion greens is a nice kind of food-based natural liver tonic.
Okay. What do you think about probiotics and prebiotics?
Yeah, the microbiome is a really interesting conversation that we could probably spend a couple hours on. It's really interesting. And so it's, you know, the microbiome is this balance of the good and the unhealthy bacteria in our gut. We know that within MPN patients that it's dysregulated, and even within ETPV and MF that there's different alterations that we're seeing. We don't know the best way to really target that. And so there's some data looking at long-term probiotic use and what that does to the microbiome. And it actually over time in some studies limits the diversity. And that's what we're really trying to achieve is diversity. And so my recommendation is to really focus on healthy microbiome activities, which include a healthful diet, Mediterranean diet, physical activity, stress reduction, good sleep. So general wellness is what leads to microbiome health. And then things like bone broth can help because of the collagen. So bone broth supplementation once per day or collagen can help. And fermented foods, so things like kefir, sauerkraut, kimchi. I love kimchi. So these are nice to incorporate. And then in regards to the probiotic supplementation, if you've been on a chronic probiotic, to shift to a new one periodically to get a new strain, and then to really do it in short courses, what I've been really recommending for patients, 2 to 4 weeks, and in particular after antibiotic exposure, after colonoscopy, or certainly after 3 months or later after bone marrow transplantation.
Sure. Are there benefits for MPN patients to fasting or hot saunas?
Good question. Well, the fasting literature is really fascinating. And so, you know, We are meant as animals from our evolution to have periods of feeding and fasting, right? And our body really needs these periods of fasting to undergo our cellular cleaning mechanisms. And so there was a beautiful paper in 2019, I think it was, in the New England Journal that looked at all the different mechanisms that are triggered from fasting, and even as little as 13 hours. And it's really fantastic. The genes are actually regulated differently. The tumor suppressor genes are upregulated. Tumor promoters are downregulated. We know that a lot of the drivers of our cardiometabolic health are actually changed in a positive way. And so our lipid profiles, our fasting, insulin handling, insulin-like growth factor are all changed in positive ways. What's not changing is weight, often in these studies, which is kind of interesting. So it's enough for me to do it. I'm an intermittent faster. I think it's changed my own blood pressure. I'm an N of one, right? It's changed my own blood pressure. I feel more energetic and have more mental clarity. And so that's my own experience. I've written a grant in it and looking at, I think we need to look at more of the data. So if you go to the ACS paper about it, they say, no, I don't recommend it because we do not have high quality evidence for it yet. But there's a paper, a recent review, a meta-analysis, and I think it was the Journal of Nutrition, that actually is kind of supporting it and saying that particularly prior to chemotherapy, and granted, not many NPNs, unless you're in blast phase, are really undergoing chemotherapy. But prior to chemotherapy, it can really enhance the tolerance of chemotherapy with less neutropenia and less side effects. So I think the jury is still out on how it's modulating NPN disease, but with what we're seeing in other diseases, and particularly in mouse models with the cardiometabolic health, I certainly hypothesize that there will be positive impacts on NPN patients with future study.
Great. Should leafy greens like kale and spinach be limited in ET patients, ET JAK2 patients, because of the high vitamin K content, which exacerbates blood clotting?
I truly think the amount of vitamin K in our leafy greens is not going to impact the risk for blood clotting events. And I think it's even true. And another question I often get is, can I eat that when I'm on an anticoagulant, and particularly Coumadin, right? And, you know, as long as you're eating a consistent diet of leafy greens, your anticoagulation, your INR can be adjusted to that. And there's so many health benefits of our leafy greens for our microbiome, for our general health and wellness, that I would recommend continuation of eating those important components of the diet.
Any current or past study trials on keto or near keto, low sugar with MPNs? I haven't seen any, but.
No, in fact, I just recently looked at the data again at that, and there is nothing in MPNs, although a really robust set of literature in glioblastoma or brain cancers. There's some out there for pancreatic, ovarian. So in our solid tumors, there is an emerging data set, particularly in mouse models and less so clinical trials. You know, in brain cancer, it really is impacting survival and treatment tolerance. So that's very provocative. In other cancers, it's not as provocative. But if you go to clinicaltrials.gov and you put in keto diet and cancer, there's 65 trials, last I looked, ongoing. And that's because there's really a sound rationale for it, that we know that our cancer cells are what we call glucose addicted. They prefer non-oxidative phosphorylation, even in the presence of oxygen, which makes them very unique. And so they really like glucose as a substrate for metabolism, and other cells have an adaptive mechanism. And so because of that, it's really been it's researched heavily and is an area of interest.
Well, that's all the time we have today. I could speak to you about this for another hour at least, and I appreciate
it. I know, me too. Oh my gosh, it's really a joy. Thank you so much for everything that you're doing for the MPN patient population and advocating for this whole wonderful community. Thank you.